So, brethren, we are continuing in our side study of heads and horns. We are officially supposed to be in Revelation 13:1 with the beast with seven heads and ten horns and the crowns upon the horns. But we are continuing in Revelation, the 17th chapter. As strange as it might seem at first, we're going to end up going through this chapter verse by verse, because on any study of the heads and horns, this chapter is one of the most insightful in giving us insight into that subject. Yet it's a very complex chapter, but I think we all will find it quite satisfying at a reasonable explanation. Now, I'm going to go through this in maybe a little different manner. We started last week. We got up to verse 7. But I can see that for some of you, you're long seasoned and well acquainted with this chapter. And for others, this is your first time considering it verse by verse. And I'm going to try to slow down my usual talking speed. We will go verse by verse for comments, but I want to overview it first. Part of the reason is there are changes in time during this chapter. And if we don't observe where these changes in time take place, it makes it more difficult to understand how to interpret those verses. Now, we started that last week. We're going to continue. And I know that all of us has other studies. The class has three other studies, and we know Toronto has their studies, and other brethren have their studies. So we understand that some of you haven't read this chapter since last week. So it all is good. Now, a simple observation. The word woman or her, referring to the woman, which we have come to learn as a harlot, appears 11 times in these 18 verses. The beast appears 8 times. And kings appears 4 times. And the seven heads and 10 horns together appear twice. This chapter is giving us a snapshot of the interaction of the harlot woman, which is the apostate church, and her interaction with the beast, and the interaction with the various kings, all this is what we're going to consider, but this is the thrust of this chapter. So I'm going to give an overview, as it were, and then we'll go through it verse by verse. If it takes us into next week, I won't be surprised, but that's okay. So verse 1 and 2 is one time period. And Sister Cheryl, could you read that, please? Verses 1 and 2.
And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear.
Are we reading in Revelation 17, 1 and 2?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm in 13. Sorry.
No problem.
And there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have made drunk with the wine of her fornication.
All right, thank you. So instead of our usual have opening comments, I'm just going to share some thoughts here as part of the overview. We'll come back. So the time period is shown us actually in verse 10. Sister Cheryl, could you read verse 10?
And there are seven kings. Five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space.
All right, thank you. So, brethren, this verse, so important, it demonstrates that these seven kings are successive in nature. These seven kings are not contemporary, per se. You have seven successive forms of government, which we've learned. And we are in the vision of this chapter. It starts in the sixth head. Five are fallen. Five of these kings are the same as the seven heads. We'll get to that. Five of the forms of government are passed. We're in the sixth form of government. We think this is a time period of Victor Emmanuel the First. This would be a time period starting in 1870 AD and continues to approximately the 1930s. This is a time period when the messenger, one of the seven messengers which had the plagues, this messenger, we believe, of course, is Brother Russell, and that it's through his writings of the volumes particularly that he is showing the John class, those of us, spirit begotten now, or as it were, from this 1870 time period onward, so to speak, he's showing us through his writings, he's pointing out who this harlot woman is, this apostate church we particularly identify as papacy. But any apostate church, any church that gets involved with the governments of earth are demonstrating they're not waiting for the true king, their bridegroom Jesus, but rather they're getting involved with earthly kingdoms. So that's called fornication. That's an illicit relationship. So that's an apostate or an unchaste church. Primarily the tares of the parable of the wheat and tares. They would be these, this would be the apostate church. And it's the system. It's the church system. Okay. So that's our setting in these two verses. Then, Ruth, would you read for us verses 3-6?
So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration.
All right, thank you. So, brethren, we discussed this last week. Verse 3 is showing us that Brother Russell's writings, so he carried me away. Brother Russell's writings expose the past history of the Antichrist system. And we're looking back during that wilderness period of 1260 years from 539 to 1799. And we're reading in these verses about how this harlot woman, the papal system, was empowered and ruled with the kings of the earth that she had intoxicated, confused their thinking by teaching them that if the church crowned them as king, so to speak, then they had God's or divine approval to be kings and lord it over their subjects. This is a time period of the Holy Roman Empire, so-called Holy Roman Empire. This wilderness time period, it starts in 539, it's true, we're starting it, but predominantly it's 800 to 1799, predominantly 800 AD, when Charlemagne was crowned by the Pope in 800 AD through 1799. But it incorporates that grander wilderness period of 539 to 1799. So the true church is in a wilderness condition outside of the city and can properly view, the true church can properly view the heinous, pompous conduct of the apostate church. And we get down to verse 6. And as we read last week, the John class marvels, not in appreciation, but as startled, amazed at the this horrific power that the Antichrist system had had during their heyday of the Dark Ages, during the periods of the Inquisition and the suppression of the truth and the truth people. Now, with verse 7, we're leaving that look into the past. We're leaving that 1260 year period. We're no longer in the spirit being taken back. We're now back into this sixth king or sixth head period of time from 1870 onward for the viewpoint, as we continue in this chapter. That wilderness time, the 539 to 1799, particularly the 800 to 1799, that was the fourth head period. So verses 3 through 6 would be a reference to, you could include the third head, but predominantly the fourth head period. And I'm saying that because we're in the sixth head viewpoint when we open the chapter. So we went back in time, and now we're coming back to this sixth head and onward time period, starting in verse 7. And Sister Carrie, could you read for us verse 7 and 8, please?
And the angel said unto me, wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carried her, which hath the heavens, the seven heads and 10 horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was, and is not, and yet is.
All right, thank you. So once again, it's Brother Russell's writings from the sixth head period onward, 1870 onward, as it were, that we are now being instructed to learn about the mystery of the woman and the beast that carried her. So this is telling us in verse 7, it's going to show us the mystery about the beast which carried her, has the seven heads and ten horns. So we're identifying this as the Roman Empire. The beast which you saw was. Now, hold on a second here. The beast which you saw was. That was in that previous verse time period when you were taken back in history. This is back during the 800 to 1799 period that this beast was. The beast is a church-state system. It's a church-state government. And that was what the Holy Roman Empire was. It was a beastly form of government, a religious form of government. And that was what we're identifying as the fourth head time period. That's when this beast that carried the woman, she rode the beast. She was in control of the reign. She was directing the beast, directing this form of government during that period of the Holy Roman Empire. That was the beast that was. And it tells us that now it is not. That beast is not. That form of government currently is not. It's not in existence. And shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into destruction. So that beast, that form of government, church and state, is going to ascend again in the future. Is going to come back. We're going to have another church-state form of government, which the woman, the apostate church, will again have large influence over. But when it comes into existence again, it's going to be destroyed. It's not going to go back into a bottomless pit condition. It's going to actually be destroyed, never to be again. So we read more on that, but that's what this is telling us. Now we'd like to, like I said, we're going to come back and go verse by verse, but here's our overview. Let's now, Sister Gina, you good to read today? Good. Can you read 9 through 11 for us, please?
Here is the mind that hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And they are seven kings. The five are fallen. The one is. The other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a little while. And the beast that was and is not is himself also an eighth and is of the seven. And he goeth into perdition.
All right. Thank you. So, brethren, with this verse 9 starts out, here's the mind which hath wisdom. Again, indicates a little bit of change. It's giving us this information. And here's the information. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. Mountains are kingdoms, and the seven heads are seven kingdoms. The woman sits or has some level of influence. So the woman, the apostate church, has to be in existence during the time we start counting our seven heads or seven forms of government known as kingdoms over the Roman Empire. The woman, apostate church, has to at least be in existence to help us understand when the Lord wants us to start counting these heads, forms of government, until they're concluded. We get that much. Now, we see in verse 10, again emphasizing the seven heads or seven mountains, seven forms of government are successive. Not unlike the seven stages of the church are successive that we read about. But they don't exist at the same time. One form of government succeeds the next form of government. And so it continues. There's going to be a reason why this is so pointed, but suffice that to say now. In verse 11, the beast that was and is not, that's the beast we were just told about. That's the church-state system that had been during the fourth head, during the Holy Roman Empire period. The beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth. Yes, that church-state system is going to reemerge. It's going to ascend out of the bottomless pit. And when it does, it is going to go into destruction. It's not going to go back into the bottomless pit condition. It's going to be destroyed. That's the eighth head, the repeat head. Let's hold that, leave that. We'll see some more detail down the road on this. Sister Bessie, could you read for us verses 12 and through 14? 12 to 14.
12 through 14. And the ten horns that you saw are the kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they had over their power and authority to the beast. Continue.
Yeah, through 14. Mm-hmm.
They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful.
Okay, very good. So, brethren, in verse 9, 10, and 11, we were learning about the seven heads, that they are seven kings, depicted by seven mountains. Here, now, the Revelator is teaching us about ten horns, and the ten horns are ten kings. But we read that these ten kings will give their power at once, unitedly, to the beast. So you see the ten kings of the picture by the ten horns are not successive. They coexist at the same time. And unitedly they give their power to the beast. The beast is this eighth head. It's a church state government that's going to reemerge yet in the future. And the ten kings or ten lesser kings, lesser powers, are going to unite and give their power unto this eighth head church state arrangement. Now, in saying that, we're seeing the difference between a mountain, the seven heads, our seven kings, our seven mountains, a empire form of government, versus ten kings which coexist at the same time. These are like hills. These are like hills. They're smaller governments. They're like having ten countries cooperate as part of one big empire. You have ten countries that are part of the European Union, for example. It's demonstrating to us that ten is a complete number, and seven is a complete number in its own way. But it's demonstrating that there is a time in the future when these complete lesser regional powers or governments are going to cooperate in the grander overarching church state government. When they do, it's for a short period of time, and they have one mind. You see these 10 kings, they have one mind. They're all together at the same time. And that they will have, they're going to give their power and strength to the beast. And the beast as a church state system will once again use the power of the state to persecute the true church. This beast is going to act like it did back during the heyday of the Holy Roman Empire. Who's behind this beast? It's Satan. Satan's favorite system is the Antichrist system, the apostate church system. But it needs to work with the kings of earth, the powers, the civil authorities, in order to persecute. We learn that historically. That's why the Lord here in Revelation took us back in history to see what the beast had done in the past, so that when it reemerges in the future, we expect it to act the same way. It's just going to be for a much shorter period of time. Not that long period of the fourth head, 800 AD to 1799, but rather a short 1 hour period, the eighth head period. And it does exactly that. It goes to make war with the Lamb. And how do you make war with the Lamb? How do you make war with Jesus Christ? He's an exalted spirit being. By making war and persecuting his feet members, sealed but still in the flesh. And yet, with this final conflict, it's going to end up bringing the glorification of the church, the complete 144,000 on the other side of the veil, spiritual glory. They will be martyred. And then this will lead to the demise and the complete destruction of the church state system, the papacy, the harlot daughters. All apostate church systems will be destroyed. It's as another way of saying those bundled tares, the nominal Christians bundled in their denominations, will all be burned. They'll all realize that they weren't true Christians. Now we're going to continue to move forward here. Verse 15, it's just one verse that we'll read here. And Sister Molly, can you read verse 15 for us, please?
Yes. Then the angel said to me, "The waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages."
Okay, thank you. So, brethren, simply a reference back to our first verse. Brother Russell's writings have shown us that the woman, when she's not sitting on the beast, she's sitting on the waters. The waters are the people who support the apostate churches as a religious system. Not necessarily a government, the religious government, which it is, but they support the church systems for their religious teachings and their beliefs. So for example, today we have the papacy has a billion followers, they estimate. Those are all around the world. Those are the waters that she's seated upon. They support her as a church, apostate church system. They think she's true, but we know it's apostate. So she sits upon the waters there. So let's take a moment and think. The woman sits upon the water sometimes. The woman sits upon the beast sometimes, And in our verse 9, there's an aspect in which the woman sitteth upon the seven mountains or seven kings or the seven heads. It's easy for us to explain the seven, the woman sitting on the beast. That's very clear. It's easy for us to explain how the woman is seated upon the waters, upon the peoples. That's interpreted for us. That's quite clear. We have to do some reasoning on how the woman sits on seven mountains. Now we're going to take an aside on that before we finish these last few verses. Sister Debbie.
I just wanted to add a little note that, if on verse 9, if you weren't sure, I think the Lord gave us additional, literal information, because Rome is, the nickname of Rome is actually the city that sits on seven hills, the city of seven hills. So I know hills aren't mountains, but it's just that it kind of corroborates, you know, the idea. And of course, Jerusalem is surrounded by seven hills, but it seems like you could see that Rome is almost like a counterfeit with that. That's all. Over.
Yeah, I was going to save that till we went through verse by verse. But if you want to, like Sister Debbie just did, if you want to Google, a city that sits on seven hills, Rome is predominantly the one that comes up. But Jerusalem comes up, Dubois, Iowa comes up, and there's a whole list of seven-hilled cities around the world. But predominantly, Rome was known as that seven-hilled city. The first hill that Romulus was built upon was the hill known as the Palatine Hill. Subsequently, the other hills were villages. It was marshy swamp between the various hills, but over time it coagulated and united into being Rome. And so the reformers viewed this verse in their time, not having the benefit of so much history past, that they identified this seven mountains and the woman as being the papacy emanating from the literal city of Rome. All right. Sister Cheryl, please.
Thank you. I hope it's an okay time to ask a question. I'm a little confused with verse 10, looking at the seven forms of government. We have Victor Emmanuel as the sixth, and yet maybe it's because it's the early harvest gleaning in the comment book. It has restored papacy as the sixth and Victor Emmanuel as the seventh. So that confused me. And if Victor Emmanuel is the sixth, I'm not sure who the seventh is, because we know the eighth goes back to papacy, so I can't see how the seventh would be restored papacy. So I'm a little confused. So if you want to address it now, it's good. If not, I can wait. Over.
We are going to go through that as we go verse by verse. However, if you, the harvest gleanings are a little challenging because it's some early writings, and I personally don't put a lot of stock in it. I sift through it, and so do most of the brethren. In fact, I don't know of any, brethren recently who just accept that list of heads there. But you look at it, consider it. I really, outside of recognizing that this view is during the time period of the sixth head, that's this chapter view, which would put us in the days of Brother Russell. Other than that, however someone wants to align their heads, one caveat is that the woman sits on the seven heads. In some sense, she's in existence. So I think you have to limit your seven heads or seven governments at the time when the apostate church was in existence. That's the one caveat. So I sent out an email, back a while ago, and on the third page, I suggested seven heads of the beast. I thought we'd go through that a little bit more, in particular onto why. But the first one is Constantine, in the Western Empire, from 313 to 476. The second one is the period of the Goths, from 476 to 539. The third head is Justinian I, from 527 to 800. The fourth is Charlemagne and Papal Roman Empire. Charlemagne and the Papal Roman Empire, from 800 to 1799. And this is a counterfeit millennium. This is the so-called Holy Roman Empire. The fifth is Napoleon and his descendants, 1799 to 1870. The sixth is Victor Emmanuel, 1870 and onward. The seventh is the fascist Nazi regime, the 1930s ending in 1945. And the eighth is the repeat head. He is of the seven. This is a return of a church and state government that was like the fourth head, the so-called Holy Roman Empire period. Now, there are differences, but in my mind, I guess we'll deal with this a little bit here. The aspect of the woman sitteth on the seven. I would suggest that the woman representing the apostate church has to be in existence during these seven successive forms of government. Let's look back in Revelation 12. In Revelation 12, let's read, Sister Alice, could you read for us in Revelation 12 verses 3 through 5, please?
Revelation 12, 3. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having seven heads and ten horns and seven crowns upon his heads. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne.
Okay, thank you. Very good. So, brethren, here is a point to consider. Here's a point to consider. This great red dragon is depicted as having seven heads, ten horns, crowns upon the horns. So this is an identifier of the Roman Empire. But the focus is that it's a dragon. You notice it's not a beast. This is showing that the civil power is the leading authority. That's why the crowns are on the heads. And it's upon this head. And this head is when Constantine, the tail of that dragon, converted to Christianity, because the apostate woman, that element of the Antichrist, the element of the Nicolaitan spirit was already in existence. Remember, the woman was pregnant, waiting to be delivered. And when she gave birth, she bore the the man child. So it's, in my mind, demonstrating that the apostate church in its infancy was on the scene, not in control, but on the scene, influencing the first head, which was Constantine. the nominally converted first Christian of the Roman Empire. This is where the Lord, I think, is giving us an indicator that we should start counting our seven heads so that we can recognize that what the Lord is interested in is not pagan Rome of old. He's not interested in old imperial Rome. He's not interested in the old republic Rome. He's interested is when the so-called Christian Rome, nominal Christian Rome in 313 AD began, and Constantine actually called the first church council. He called these bishops the tail of the dragon. And what did he do? He took advice from the apostate church, the Athanasiuses, who said God and Jesus were the same substance, and he condemned the true church, the Arius group, who said that God and Jesus are separate. So we see the woman, the apostate element, had an influence with that leader. So all we're saying in this, if you will, is that when we read in Revelation 17, verse 9, that the woman sits on the seven heads, which are seven mountains, it's just indicating to us our time frame for starting to count the successive forms of government over the Roman Empire. And as we just demonstrated, we think we start with Constantine. And this apostate woman did have an influence with him. And so we're going back to this expression. In Revelation 17, we're shown the woman sitting on the water during the sixth head time frame. We're shown that the woman is supported, the apostate church is supported by peoples for their religious beliefs during the sixth head, because the sixth head is not a church state, not a church and state. We're suggesting it's Victor Emmanuel I, who actually took the papal states away from the papacy and united Italy as one country. Sixth stage. So the woman is on, supported by the waters. But when we looked, when we were taken back in the wilderness to see the woman riding the beast with seven heads and ten horns, we were shown historically by Brother Russell's writings that the papacy in her heyday was a church state system during that fourth head time period. And that will revive again in the future as the eighth head, which is still future. Back to Sister Cheryl's question in part, in verse 11, the beast that was and is not, that was the church and state system, papacy controlling the Roman Empire. It was and it is not. That is, during the time of the sixth head, it is in the bottomless pit. So it is not, because you're in the sixth head. It had been the fourth head, but time has gone by. We had a fifth head, Napoleon, who helped put it in the bottomless pit. We're in the sixth head, Victor Emmanuel, who united Italy. The seventh head that's yet to come for a short time is the fascists and Nazis, who, with their Fourth Reich, their fourth reign, Hitler tried to unite the Roman Empire for 1,000 years. That's the Fourth Reich. And yet they were defeated, and they were over in 1945. It was a short time period, the 1930s to the 1945. And the eighth head has not yet come. That's still a future event. But when it does, it's going to be this beast coming back out of the bottomless pit. And it will make war with the Lamb. All right. So We're going to go back through this, as we're saying. Everyone can have their comments. We're happy to entertain them. Sister Cheryl.
I just wanted to say thank you. I did find that email where you did send out and with that list so that you know you don't send them to me in vain. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Let's finish this overview here. Let's read verses 16 through 18. There's a startling insight here. It's kind of, y'all, we can read over it. I know I did for years, but it's startling insight. Sister Debbie, could you read that for us, verses 16 through 18?
From the youngs, and the 10 horns that thou didst see upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and shall burn her in fire. For God did give unto their hearts to do its mind, and to make one mind, and to give their kingdom to the beast till the sayings of God may be complete. And the woman that thou didst see is the great city that is having reign over the kings of the land.
Okay, good. Thank you. So that was Young's. Let me just ask, anyone have a diaglot or NIV handy? I don't happen to have one here. Brother David, please. Could you read for us that those same verses? We're just going to hear it from another perspective.
16 through 18, Brother Rick.
Please.
And the 10 horns which thou sawest, and the beast, these will hate the harlot, and will make her desolate and naked, and will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God inclined their hearts to do his purpose, even to execute one purpose and to give their kingdom to the beast till the words of God shall be completed. And the woman whom thou sawest is that great city which holds sovereignty over the kings of the earth.
Over. Okay, very good. Thank you. You could pick up there's a distinction in several places with the Youngs, but it's okay. We could sort through this. It seems pretty clear by the context of the chapter that we read. The 10 horns, those are those 10 kings who are coexisting at the same time. We had read that they give their power to the beast. They're united in their desire to have a church-state system to control the people. The beast is the apostate, the woman is the apostate church, which they really don't care for, but the beast is the government of a church and state, which they cooperate in. But they end up turning these 10 kings, they end up turning against the harlot woman. And the body of the beast, the people who were under that church state rule, they also turn on the woman. They are, we believe it's the revealed truth of the 7 last plagues that will lead to the nominal Christians realizing that the apostate church is not the true church, and they've been misled. And they reject it. And this will lead to the great earthquake, the revolution that divides the city. And this will then turn into the fire of anarchy, which will lead to the utter destruction of that harlot woman, the apostate church. Verse 18 confirms that the apostate church, that woman, that harlot, is the same as the great city which had reigned over the kings of the earth. This is the kings of the earth. The earth are people under religious restraint. She had this influence over the kings of the earth. This seems so incredible that the apostate system of papacy and her apostate church daughters, they influenced, they intoxicated the kings of the earth once again in the future for a short hour. And it infuriates these kings when they get their mind cleared from that intoxicating false doctrine. And yet it's so marvelous that she was able to do this, but it's all because Satan's behind that system. But here's the gem thought, brethren. Verse 17, God desired that they would do this one more time. God desired that there would be this eighth head. God desired that there would once again be a church-state system, even though they would make war on the final feet members. God knew that their martyrdom would lead to the utter destruction. Not going back into the bottomless pit. No, no. That beast, that church-state system cooperation will be forever destroyed, burned with fire. And the harlot systems will be done away with, burned with fire, destroyed. The people will finally be freed from all that intoxicating worldly thinking, and they'll be prepared for the blessings of the peaceable kingdom, which will follow after that trouble. So the 17th chapter, again, 11 times the woman is mentioned, 8 times this beast is mentioned, 4 times the kings are mentioned. And yet it's the chapter depicting the history of the interaction between the apostate church woman and the kings of the earth, how they began, what they're going to do in the future, and what the conclusion will be. And God had used it all to his glory and serve his purpose. Sister Debbie and then Brother Adi.
Just an interesting point with the youngs. It says in verse 17, for God did give into their hearts to do its mind and to make one mind. And in the King James, or the American Standard, I'll go to the American Standard, for God did put it in their hearts to do his mind and to come to one mind. So I'm wondering, is that it's correct, or is it his? Because is it God's mind, or is it its mind, the mind of the beast, to join with the people to make one mind between them against this woman? Over.
Yes, that's one of the reasons why we had Brother David reread those verses from another translation. And we do think it is the context of verse 17 demonstrate that this is what God has done. So the main point is that God desired for them to cooperate in a united way to participate in this church state system, the eighth head, because in the end it was going to lead to their destruction. So I think it's they're fulfilling God's will. Now, I was reflecting on that point, and I'm not going to get us sidetracked in it. I'm going to plant some seed thoughts. You probably have already thought ahead on this. When we see how God has designed this for this eighth head arrangement, this church state arrangement, and a final test and then there's destruction, doesn't it sound familiar to Ezekiel 38, how God puts the hook in the jaw and leads Magog's host down against Israel, the natural seed? And he puts the hook in their jaw to come down to chasten his people, to test them. But in the end, he destroys them. That's all in Ezekiel 38. But the Lord put the hook in their jaws to bring them down to do his will. Remember how the Lord allowed Satan as a covering cherub in Eden to test Adam and Eve. And we'll remember that Satan is in a bottomless pit, Revelation 20, to come out of the bottomless pit at the end of the 1,000 years to once again go up and test mankind. But then Satan will be completely destroyed. And we read in 2 Thessalonians 2 that the Lord designed that there would be great deceptions to test all those who would love the truth. So it's indicating that the Heavenly Father, God, is not being surprised by any of these seemingly negative developments on the part of Satan, but rather he uses it to test his people, the true seed, spiritual, or the natural seed. And when he's done using them, they're destroyed. So I marvel at, I hadn't focused on that in the past, but it's so clear now. Badrari.
So one argument that mankind could have against God is, if he didn't allow this last test to happen, is that they didn't have the truth. The truth was hidden. And the persecution, if they had the truth, that they wouldn't have done what they did to the church. But that it happens one more time when all this truth is flooding the world, it shows that it's not the fact that they didn't have the truth, but the evil that they had in their hearts. Over.
Okay, thank you. Ruth.
I was just taking a quick look at that reprint, 2062.
Okay.
Russell says that Victor Emmanuel is the seventh head.
Yeah.
And he explains why. Because Victor Emmanuel had taken away the power from the papacy and taken away their land. And Brother Russell never lived to see them get it back under Mussolini. That Mussolini gave back some of their, not all of it, but some of their land and lots of money to the papacy. And that's what they used to invest and become the colossal financial, in the colossal financial position they're in today. And he never lived to see that. So there was no way for him to know how much time would pass and to see this other head rise up and give them that back. So anyway, it's helpful to me to read why he thought that and to see how at the time he lived, you could understand why he thought that at that time. Over.
All very true. And that's why I think for us living now, it's easier to look back over this chapter in Revelation, these chapters, and with more passage of time, more fulfillment prophecy, we can follow what he has shown us. He's this angel that's even shown us this history to understand and then put it into perspective, how true that is. Sister Carrie.
With Nazi fascism being part of that series, is that considered within those years time frame or afterward?
The fascist Nazis and Mussolini was a fascist. It was part of the fascist Nazi axis, and they were allies with Germany, as you know, and Austria at the beginning. But nonetheless, it's from the 1930s, but it ended sharply in 1945. And so it was a short period, very short period. So I hope that helps. That's the seventh. We line it up, and many brethren line it up as the seventh head. Yeah. Sister Debbie.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that Mussolini did not give papacy the land back that was taken away by Victor Emmanuel, but he gave them Rome. So that the environs of Rome are separate. If I'm wrong, please correct me, because that's what I always thought. Over.
So the emphasis on what Mussolini did was he gave about 1 billion lire to the Vatican. And this allowed them to once again to become more prominent. They loved them. The papacy loved Mussolini for doing this. And the people loved Mussolini. They called him El Duce because he embraced papacy. And the Vatican states that Victor Emmanuel I had taken away from papacy. Those Vatican states were not restored to papacy. The papacy was reduced to the Vatican City area and whatever church lands they have. that they still have. But as far as if you looked at a map of the papal states, you would see that that's what Pepin the Short and then Charlemagne, his son, had given to the Bishop of Rome in their day, in the 700s, late 700s. And that was a large swatch of land of Italy. And so Victor Emmanuel I is considered to have reunited what we know as modern Italy. And that still exists. Ruth.
I was just going to say that there's a book I read called The Vatican Billions, and it traces how the papacy today owes their influence and power to basically what Mussolini gave them, and it documents everything he did. So if anyone's interested in all the gory details, it's a very fascinating book. And they give all the references and everything. I don't remember all of it, but it was just phenomenal. What he gave back to them after they had lost it. And again, Brother Russell never lived to see that. So, and to see how they spun it into the colossal power they are today in the world financially. Over.
Okay. All right. Very good. Great. Okay. Sister Debbie.
Just a note that I have a better grasp of what you're saying because I'm, you know, I've read the second volume through again, and The Man of Sin, it just refreshed everything in my mind so that what you're saying is more clear than had I not reread the second volume. And I would suggest that to anybody because it makes Revelation a little more clear. Over.
Well, it's true. The second and the third and the fourth volume and the 1912 forward to the fourth volume, especially, we can readily see how, it's that angel. Brother Russell as the seventh messenger and have, it's his writings. Again, we emphasize it's the writings, the teachings, that has given us the insight to look back historically at what the papacy had been. A church-state system and persecuted the saints and the truth and how it was submersed by Napoleon rising, and yet how it apparently, according to what we think these scriptures mean, is going to rise one more time. And Brother Russell did expect a future rise. If you had any doubts about that, I'm not saying anyone here does, but if you reread the 1916 forward to the fourth volume, it's very, very plain that he expected that after the war, that he lived during World War One, but he died during World War One, transitioned, graduated. But he felt that it was after the war that the nominal churches would again rise to power with the governments and persecute the true church. So, okay. We'll leave it there. So I thought with that overview, we could go back and go through these verses and allow for comments and questions. But I thought the overview for those of us not as familiar with this, it would be a lot easier than just trying to interpret a verse at a time without seeing the different, time viewpoints. Okay. So, I think, did anyone have any comments on verses 1-6, which we had talked about a lot last week? We went verse by verse. This was, I thought we pretty well cover it, but did anyone have any comments or questions on verses 1-6? Sister Debbie?
Is that in chapter 17 or in 13?
No, 17.
Okay.
All right. So the friends are pretty well convinced there. So let's pick up in verse 7. And what we'd like to do is, let's read 7 and 8 together, kind of like we had done, and then we'll comment on that. And Sister Connie, could you read that for us, 17, 7 and 8, please?
And the angel said unto me, wherefore didst thou wonder? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the 7 heads and the 10 horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and to go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, they whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast, how that it was and is not and shall be present.
Okay. Sister Connie, who is this? Who is this woman represent again?
The apostate.
All right. Very good. Exactly. And, do you have a thought on this beast, what this beast represents?
Well, the apostate church, so it would be the civil and religious together.
Exactly. Perfect. Very good. And, Brother Dan, what does it mean? This beast that thou sawest was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. What is that telling us?
It means that they were formerly, in power, and now they've gone into the abyss. They're out of power at this point in time. But they shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. So they will come back into power as the, 8th head or form of government. So, just as we've been discussing, this is the period of time when, Napoleon, put them in the abyss. Just giving us looking back at history from the perspective of their period of power to persecute, and then losing that power, but they will come back into power as the 8th head at the end of the gospel age. Over.
Okay, very good, very good. So, brethren, this beast, this church state government, known as, we put it as the 4th head of the Holy Roman Empire, starting with Charlemagne. It's in the abyss, as Brother Dan has brought out. It ceased to exist during the 5th head, Napoleon, during the 6th head, Victor Emmanuel, and during the 7th head, the Nazi fascist regime. But yet, when the 8th head reoccurs in the future, it's going to be one of the 7 coming back. This is this beast. And we're told it's this beast that the 10 kings will give their power to. It confirms it because in verse 11, and the beast that was and is not, you notice it was and is not during this viewpoint of being in the 6th head, in the viewpoint of being during the Victor Emmanuel period. But it's the 8th, and it's of the 7, and we'll go into destruction. It's of the 7 because it was, but had been in the abyss. So now it isn't. But it will be again in the future when it ascends out of the abyss, when church and state comes back into existence. Okay. Brother Michael.
So I have a question, and it's basically the function of why there's a need for A, the beast to have the power in the first instance, and then B, for it to go away, and then for it to come back. Because I've not been able to tie exactly, so it would appear to me that the reason why it's given power so that he can wage war against the Lamb. But to what end? You know, because I mean, I'm just trying to understand exactly why is this beast given that power? Why was it taken away despite the fact that the kingdom has not been established at this point? Yes, we know it's going to lead into the peaceable kingdom, but then the reappearance again of it, there just seems to be, for me, I can't seem to connect the reason why they have this power. What's the objective for the power?
Okay, that's good. Ruth, are you answering that question?
Well, I'll wait my turn. It's all right.
Now you can go ahead and answer it, and then I'll comment after you.
Well, it's a very good question, and it seems to me that the permission, it's like the permission of evil on the church. The Lord allowed this terrible permission of evil over his church throughout the gospel age to test them, to try them, to demonstrate the power of the adversary. And then when he had the beast go into the bottomless pit, it was during the time of the end when it was time for the truth to be able to be manifested. And so he took their power away so the truth could be revealed, starting in 1799. Like they were like the Dark Ages. They were against all education. They were against all scientific advances. They were against everything to do with truth, not only biblically, but, you know, scientifically and the rights of man. So he took them away and put them in the bottomless pit so they couldn't control it anymore, so that the Lord would allow the truth to be demonstrated. And then he allowed the harvest message to be given, and he allowed that to be spread worldwide, and he allowed the Lord's people to get that so that they could be sealed with the truth. And so then when that is all basically accomplished, he'll allow this to come back for a short period to test them, and then they'll be destroyed. So anyway, that's my viewpoint on it. Over.
All right. Well, I think that answers it quite well. It's answering the philosophy of why the Lord allows this beast or this harlot to have such influence to persecute. And it's the philosophy is it's for the development. It's primarily for the development and testing of those who would be true to the Lord and to the truth. And before I call on Brother Adi, we remember that Jesus had this. Who persecuted Jesus? Yes, the Romans were the one that abused him in the end. That's true. But the Romans wouldn't have done that of their own. The Romans didn't really care about Jesus. It was the Jewish religious leaders in their hypocrisy that Satan worked through. Remember, Satan entered Judas. Judas was there because he fell for that because he's being paid off by the religious leaders. So it was the nominal religious leaders of Jesus' day that led the civil powers to persecute him. And because the disciple is not above the head, the master, we too have to have experiences to be developed like Jesus was. And so this is true for the entire body members of Christ, one way or the other, to pass through the persecution. Some are literal, physical, some are verbal, but we all have to pass through these experiences to be developed completely. Brother Adi.
So I think, like I said before, in order for all mouths to be shut before God, and that he stands, he's the one that's just, and that the people throughout the ages gave their power and influence to the church when the truth was hidden, and it was is hidden in a dead language. At the end here, the truth is available to everyone. They have Bibles in their language. They could say, well, this would never happen if we knew about, if we had a Bible in our language and we could study ourselves. Yet it shows that even if you do have the Bible in your language, even if you do have access to the truth, full access to the truth, you're going to continue to behave the same way as they did before when they didn't have access to the truth because it was in a dead language. So this is one way of God shutting people's mouth, as an argument against why, against the fact that they didn't know, and that's why they allowed the church to do what they did. Over.
All right. Very good. That's so true. So winding down here, brethren, on Brother Michael's question as well, let's take a look at that 2 Thessalonians 2, because it gives us, again, a world of insight as to the Lord's means of working. 2 Thessalonians 2, and the verse that we're particularly interested in is verse 11, but we want to note that in verse 8, we're in the period of the Lord's parousia. So we're talking during the harvest time. And then, let's see, Brother Michael, could you read there for us then in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 9 through 12, please?
Yeah. So 2 Thessalonians 2, 9 to 12. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and false signs and wonders, with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish, because they did not accept the love of the truth so as to be saved. 11. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they will believe what is false, in order that they also may be judged who do not believe the truth, but took pleasure in wickedness.
Okay, thank you. So a couple of corrections from the Greek on those verses. Brother Michael's translation is good, but in verse 9, it's whose presence, the presence from the preceding verse is Jesus, is accompanied by, not after, it's accompanied by the working of Satan with all power and lying wonders. So what we're seeing is that verse 11 is telling us that God is allowing, and he designed that during the harvest period of Jesus' presence, Satan would increase his activities of deception, and the Lord would allow that in order to test all those who love the truth. And those who don't love the truth, they aren't preserved as being of the church. Oh, they might be part of the great company, or they might just even be worldly people, but they aren't preserved to be part of the little flock, because they didn't love the truth, but rather they were okay with the deceptions. They went along with evolution. They went along with immorality, like having that homosexuality is okay with God. They went along with, you know, so many modern delusions. They went along with Christians should be in government, which is apostasy, which we've seen, harlotry. So anyway, we have to close here. But Brother Michael, anything on your question? Did we even hit the question?
Yeah, you did. It actually goes back to, because it's interesting that in our class right now, we are looking at the experience of our Lord on the Mount of Olives. And we're at the point where, you know, our Lord is before Pilate. And Pilate was like, well, guess who delivered me to you? He said, well, the sin is not on you, but the greatest sin is on the people that have delivered me to you. So in a way, yes, it does make sense, because I mean, the Lord is allowing this experience for the church, you know, so that the truth can eventually come out and make room for the peaceable kingdom.